Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Lennox Saputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start off with Mark Dunley bringing us information about a rally planned for Friday, May 3rd in Albany to call on banks to stop funding fossil fuel companies. Then, Sina Bazila Hickey talks with Dr. Xavier Coughlin, the driving force behind our People's Health Sanctuary, about how he is inspired in part by the actions of a group called the Young Lords in 1970 in the Bronx, demanding equitable health care. Later on, Hugh Johnson joins us once again for a look at weather and climate, this time discussing severe weather and, of course, his forecast for the week. After that, we hear part two of Willie Terry's coverage of the recent picketing at Ellis Hospital by the New York State Nurses Association to call for a fair contract and safe staffing. Finally, Lacey Wilson from the Underground Railroad Education Center talks with me about how the organization is developing a new program to interest youth in museum studies, including training on the practical skills needed for effective storytelling. But first, here are some headlines.
The city of Albany and multiple Hudson Valley municipalities are expected to begin adopting a new version of good cause eviction following the recent state budget. However, the measures are weaker on tenant protections than the version previously adopted by Albany.
In a key ruling to protect the environment, an administrative law judge has issued a decision rejecting Norlite's challenge to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC's, decision to modify their permit to stop allowing its toxic ash to be sold to construction companies. The judge ruled entirely in favor of the DEC and against Norlite. See our website for past coverage of issues related to Norlite.
The Federal Trade Commission last week made it a lot easier in theory for certain employees to switch jobs within the same industry, particularly in the same region, by ruling against the legality of non-compete restrictions. Labor groups such as the AFL-CIO have long disliked these employment clauses, saying they inhibit people from switching jobs for higher pay, thereby suppressing wages overall. However, the ruling has been challenged in court by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
St. Peter's Health Partners said Monday that it will keep the Burdett Birth Center in Troy open for at least 5 years, reversing course after widespread community protests about its potential closing. State grants totaling $5 million will help pay for the facility at Samaritan Hospital.
In another hit for Albany's South End, the Family Dollar store chain has announced that its store on the South Powell Street will be one of 1,000 stores the chain is closing nationwide next month. The area has no full-service grocery store, but some prepared foods will continue to be available at the Dollar General store on South Powell, which is owned by a different company and will remain open.
And that's it for our headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can join our team or contribute your financial support, see the donate button at mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us 518-272-2390. We welcome your suggestions for segment topics, too.
Now to our first story. Mark Dunley talks with Joan Sequoit about the upcoming May Tide March in Albany, sponsored by Tide Act and Rivers and Mountain Green Faith, to call on banks to stop funding climate chaos and stopping sending billions of dollars to fossil fuel companies to expand their operations.
We're talking with John Sequoit, who is a core organizer with Rivers and Mountains Green Faith Circle and also Third Act Upstate. And those groups, along with several dozen others, and I know Pause is one of them, is doing an event focusing on the need to stop banks from giving a lot of money to the fossil fuel industry. It's going to be on Friday, May 3rd, starting at noon. I believe the meeting at the SUNY Plaza in downtown Albany, State and Broad Street. Now, I know this was done about a year ago and had I think a couple hundred people at the event. So, John, why are we doing this event again?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Actually, we've had, this is the third time that Rivers and Mountains has called a bank action in downtown Albany. And we keep coming back because they persist. They're persisting in their bad actions, so we're persisting and calling them out for it. Just in the years since the Paris Climate Agreement was signed in 2015, the three banks that we're going to oppose and direct our actions to this time, TD Bank, Bank of America, and Chase, have together invested over $887 billion in fossil fuel projects. That doesn't include the numbers from 2023. They haven't been compiled yet. Our friends at bankingonclimatechaos.org will have those numbers out in another couple of weeks. And so I invite your listeners to go there if they want to see the details of how these investments are being carried out worldwide. All three of these banks that were directing our activity toward this time are amongst the top 12, the dirty dozen of banks in the world, some of the worst mega banks globally. Chase Bank, for example, is the very worst bank when it comes to investing in fossil fuels. And, you know, they've invested, what is it now? $434 billion between 2016 and 2022. They're the number one worst. And some of the projects that they have been involved in include things like the Mountain Valley Pipeline in the southeastern part of the United States, which has been opposed by all kinds of groups down there, fiercely opposed. They've pumped a lot of money into that and into the 73-mile South Gate extension of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. So they're a pretty bad actor there. They've also been involved with and a major contributor to the Carmichael Coal Project in Australia. That's an open-cut coal mine that has an annual production capacity of 60 million tons of coal. So that's the kind of projects that they're investing in at Chase. Bank of America, similarly, is investing in things that we don't want to see happen, including the Mountain Valley Pipeline again. And TD Bank has been involved in funding the Trans Mountain Pipeline in Canada, which is opposed by all kinds of indigenous groups violating their sovereignty there. And so these banks are just behaving badly, and they need to be called out for it.
Now, I was down in New York City last September for the big climate march and spent one day covering the blockade of Citibank. And in fact, I saw a couple of days ago that people got arrested again, blockading the entrance to Citibank. It's their main headquarters is in New York City. So, you know, given this ongoing protest by groups like Greenface and Third Act, Climate Chaos, and Stop the Money Pipeline, you know, are the banks listening, and how do they justify, you know, investing in these industries, fossil fuels, that are literally threatening the future of life on the planet?
I don't know how they justify it. I have a quote here from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who says, investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure is moral and economic madness. So it's not only immoral to do the things that they're doing, it also doesn't really make sense economically, except in the short term, which is the short-term profits that they care about. I mean, because these projects will eventually have to be stranded assets because we just simply cannot have them proceed and work through the decades that their investments seek to justify, because we just don't have a carbon budget for these projects to go forward. But, you know, I know that after we had the action last year on 3/21/23, we heard from Third Act, the national organization, We're a working group within Third Act for Upstate New York. We heard from them that two of the banks asked for a meeting. Now, I don't know exactly what happened, but I consider that to be some kind of progress. I think generally the strategy here is, look, we're not going to get anything done with the current state of Congress. I mean, they're having a hard time just keeping the doors open. So nothing's going to happen there. So the strategy is to shut the money off, to prevent them from continuing to invest in these fossil fuel projects that are taking us, you know, down a hole. And we feel that they are vulnerable. They're using their depositors' funds, after all, to do these investments. So if enough people start to get wise to what's going on and decide to make some changes, their brand is at risk. And I think corporations, even big ones like these banks, care about their brand. So if they start to look like the bad guy, and if they have enough depositors saying, you know what, I can't work with you anymore, I'm taking my business elsewhere, they will slowly get the message. Slowly is an important word here because we don't have a lot of time, but we just got to keep at it. We have to persist because they persist.
Now, this action is taking place on Friday, May 3rd. I believe it's starting at noon at the downtown SUNY Plaza, which is at the bottom of State Street and Broadway. Can you walk us through what does the day's event look like? I hear you have the Red Brigade coming back up again.
Oh, yeah. We have the Red Rebel Brigade, which is a wonderful, wonderful group of like a street theater group that started in London. But we have some local people who are carrying that forward. We're going to have a bagpiper to lead the procession. We're going to have what we call an assembly of faith leaders. But Rivers and Mountains Green Faith is an interfaith organization. And so one of the arguments that we like to make is that this is immoral. I mean, you can make so many arguments against these projects and against what's happening with fossil fuels, you know, economic, physics, all kinds of things, chemistry, biology, it all points away from these projects. But there's also an ethical argument here. It's just simply wrong. It's wrong to do this. It's wrong to steal the future from coming generations. It's wrong to place impossible burdens on frontline communities. And you know what? In the couple of years since we started doing this back in 2022, it's no longer frontline communities anymore. It's no longer the future. It's here right now. It's affecting us all right now. Here in the Northeast, we experienced the Canadian wildfire smoke. That was a secondary effect. But imagine, you know, this is just the opening salvo of climate chaos and the extreme weather events that we're seeing every night on the news, it seems. It's just going to keep getting worse. We really can't afford to do this. It's really wrong to do this. It's unjust to do this. And that's the case we're making, and we just need to keep making
it. So you're going to go visit these three banks? Are you going to go inside? And I assume you want people to join you. Should they bring signs, banners?
Yes, please bring signs and banners if you come. Support us in any way you can. We have almost 30 co-sponsoring organizations. Some of them are houses of worship. Some of them are like PAWS, like the group that you're involved with, Mark, and Extinction Rebellion, and on and on. The New York State Council of Churches is a co-sponsor. I mean, there's a broad swath of people who recognize that this has to stop. I don't think we're going to go into the banks this time. We did last time. We delivered letters. They've heard from us. We've delivered these letters in person. We've delivered them to the CEO and chairmen of the board of each one of these companies. We're just there to have our presence known and to let them know that we're not going to back down and that they have to stop. And so, you know, I think we'll be on the outside of the bank looking in.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with John Siegwood, Rivers and Mountains Green Faith Circle on Third Act Upstate New York. It's Friday, May 3rd at noon, SUNY Plaza, State Street, and Broadway. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Again, that was Mark talking with John Siegwood about the rally starting in Albany this Friday, May 3rd at noon at SUNY Plaza, and marching to East Capitol Park to call on banks to stop funding fossil fuel companies.
On July 14th, 1970, the Young Lords took over Lincoln Hospital in South South Bronx to demand better care, improved conditions, and a variety of patients and workers' rights for the communities of color. The Young Lords demanded a people's hospital and advocated for equitable healthcare. Their vision is one of healthcare models that inspires people's health, that inspired People's Health Sanctuary. Dr. Xavier Coughlin spoke about the influence with Sina Basila Hickey for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
People's Health Sanctuary's community health model has come from many sources, and one of those models comes from the Young Lords, a revolutionary community group composed of Latinx and Black New Yorkers, and they defined themselves as, quote, a revolutionary political party fighting for the liberation of all oppressed people, end quote. Dr. Xavier Coughlin has been one of the people leading the creation and ideology of People's Health Sanctuary and joins me now to talk about the influence of the Young Lords. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. We've been excited to talk about this. So let's begin a bit generally. What would you like people to understand about the Young Lords?
Yeah, this is such a great topic. And especially when we talk about what a people's health is and what it could be, I think it's great to look towards these inspirations and these forces that have happened in our past. And the Young Lords, for me, were one of the primary inspirations around creating like literally a people's health. They even like took over a hospital, which we'll talk over in a little bit, and called it the People's Hospital. So really like focusing on community control of our health and what it could be. You know, I think for one is to know about the Young Lords, just to know that they existed. I think they often get overshadowed by the Black Panthers. And, you know, to be honest, most people, like myself included, did not learn anything about the Black Panthers, did not learn anything about the Young Lords growing up. And so just to know that their history exists, that this was a very serious organization of young people, you know, between, some were saying 14 to 30,
right,
who enacted real change, you know, and as it was, we're not just creating an image, but we're actually enacting real change, doing the hard work of organizing in the streets. And so I think we owe a lot of respect to what they were doing and what they have created. And I think also when people think about the 70s, many people think of it as like failed movements, that the Black Panthers failed, the Young Lords failed, the hippies failed. And I think to see actually the way that their demands were able to succeed. So I think when we think about the Young Lords, they were really, which we'll talk about in a little bit, were able to connect poverty and poor health and really like foment the two together. And even on a larger scale, after their takeover, which we'll mention a little bit more, they were able to force the city to create a new hospital in a poor area, which at that time in the 70s was fairly unheard of, if anyone knows anything about the public healthcare system in New York City. They also created a huge detox program in partnership with the Black Panthers, and that has now been turned into what we call NADA, which is a 5-point acupuncture program that is used internationally for substance use and harm reduction, and has also influenced the community acupuncture model, of which PHS has recently started with, that is, again, across the country and across the world, about different ways of offering access to these more, quote-unquote, alternative or traditional healing that in our capitalist society is actually very expensive, how to create it accessible to people and that they can use. And one thing that most people don't know about the Young Lords is that whenever you walk into a hospital, they have a patient's bill of rights. And that idea came from the Young Lords. And it was significantly watered down. And, you know, the original patient's bill of rights included free access to healthcare, free preventative care, free childcare in a hospital that was open to all staff and all patients. And it was much more of a holistic way of thinking about what our rights are in a system that is trying to oppress us. But when you walk into a hospital, for whatever watered down it is, that is a long-term success of the Young Lords that we can thank them for.
Do you know, did that patient's bill of rights happen immediately, or was it years later that it actually was enacted?
Yeah, many years later. And they're very important rules that you should have informed consent, that you should have a translator. But they're kind of individualistic of like what your individual rights are as a patient. And after the many years of organizing for the Young Lords, their original content was more of like a social contract that we, the system, the hospital system, the healthcare system, as well as this like governmental system, owes this to people because we are the people who pay for it. We're the people who work there. We're the people who suffer from the consequences of environmental racism or poor corporate regulation. And so that this is actually a demand that we have.
Continuing on that, as you mentioned, they spoke about environmental racism, what at the time they called, quote, disease of poverty, end quote. Can you explain what environmental racism is and how this relates to the community in North Central Troy?
Yeah, and this is like a huge question, especially in North Central Troy. But basically, not a formal definition, but environmental racism is the use of creating poor environments. So that could be, the often used one is putting incinerators, such as Norlight, which is very near North Central Troy, a very poor socioeconomic class that is also predominantly black and brown citizens here. And so when people talk about environmental racism, it's the inadvertent or purposeful positioning of toxins and chemicals that are going to cause poor health in communities often of color and usually communities that are poor or have less resources. And so the Young Lords were huge in creating that connection. Even in their first organization or their first action was a garbage offensive where right. There was no garbage. The city was not taking garbage from the poor areas, like predominantly the black and brown areas of Harlem and South Bronx, and would leave it for weeks and weeks in the summertime rotting. And obviously this creates huge environmental consequences. And so they organized lining up the streets, like blocking the main thoroughfares between Midtown and the suburbs with all their trash until essentially the new mayor who was coming had to campaign that they were gonna clean up. They also took over a TB, back in the day they used to have these vans that would go around and take your chest x-ray if you were had TB. And TB is a definitive disease of poverty. And so there was no screening and no testing in these poor areas. And the Young Lords would often say that these vans were sent off to more affluent areas or places where there were less TB.
And I think the hours that they were in those neighborhoods were just unavailable to most people.
Yeah, exactly. Totally inaccessible. And so they actually commandeered this van, took it and forced the city to like recognize this limitation and force them to start doing more screening. Here, this is like a real demand of the people and really taking that on. And I think that's like an organizing lesson from the Young Lords that we can really take on.
And it was effective.
Yeah, super effective. And it was not this like, sexy, really revolutionary thing, but it's actually the thing that people needed. And that's actually the thing that helped gain trust in the community.
And we're quickly running out of time, but one of their really big actions in 1970 was the 12-hour takeover of Lincoln Hospital, demanding for a people's hospital. And they were bringing attention to the conditions of that particular hospital and the root causes of health disparities. Can you talk about what those health disparities were and the conditions that these communities faced?
Yeah, they called Lincoln Hospital at this time the butcher shop. And basically, there's often a critique in, especially in New York City, where I did my medical training, that the public hospitals are basically places for doctors to practice on poor people. And then when they're done with their training, they go to the more affluent suburbs. And Lincoln Hospital, I think, was probably the epitome of this. It was already in a very poor neighborhood. So the staff was very underpaid. The doctors had minimal supervision, is what most accounts say. And the sanitation issues were horrific. And so after years of organizing around this issue and really trying to get demands, petitions, rallies, going to, positions of power to try to change these, the Young Lords decided that they were not being listened to, the community was not being listened to, and they went in and took over the hospital for 12 hours and basically forced the mayor to commit to building a new hospital because of how poor the building and the actual structure of the building was. And this really led to a huge huge push for public health in that area. And the New York Times recently just released a video, The Takeover, which you can watch online, you can watch on YouTube as well, that really goes over a beautiful history of the Young Lords as well as the takeover in light of the assassination of Fred Hampton and other events that were going on in that time in the 1970s.
Where was your point of entry to learning about the Young Lords and bringing that work to People's Health Sanctuary?
Yeah, actually, I learned a lot of them actually through an author, Fitzhugh Mullins, who was a pediatric resident at this time at Lincoln Hospital. And, you know, it really was around this time of like a revolutionary medicine, I think, with looking at like Franz Fanon and some other more like revolutionary ways of thinking about medicine, like and really trying to create like what a people's medicine could be here in the U.S., you know, very influenced by the barefoot doctor mythology in China. Of like, what is it, if what would it be that we could train doctors instead of just catering to the rich, and to be rich themselves, that they would actually cater to the poor, to those who actually help them become trained, and that medicine as a vocation versus an occupation. And so, you know, for me, learning about the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, and really seeing how they took a people's health and really made that a foundation of their organizing, it helped ground it for me anyway, as a med student, into like, this is what a purpose could be. This is what a doctor of solidarity could look like, or a person in working in healthcare could look like.
I appreciate you giving me a little bit more of this history and us, the listeners, this history. The best place to find about People's Health Sanctuary is mediasanctuary.org/PHS. Yeah. Would you like to leave our listeners with anything?
Yeah. And also find us on Instagram at People's Health Troy. And sign up for our email list. And you can also see our upcoming events, such as a community acupuncture session in May, May 24th, as well as June 14th.
Thank you so much, Xavier Coughlin.
Thank you.
Wow, I didn't know anything about that part of medical history. So thanks to Dr. Xavier Coughlin for talking with Sina Bazilahickey about the Young Lords' activism in the Bronx in 1970, and how it relates to his efforts spearheading a People's Health Sanctuary in Troy in 2024. For more info about PHS, see our website at mediasanctuary.org or stop by one of those health sessions on May 24th or June 14th.
For those just tuning in, I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we get to our weekly weather update with retired National Weather Service meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Welcome back, Hugh.
Hey, how you doing, Bria?
Doing good, especially after what a beautiful day today. But I thought it was supposed to hit 80 or higher, and then the forecasters kept dialing it down. What happened?
Well, basically, Bria, we had a backdoor cold front come through. And most of the time, cold fronts come through from west to east or northwest to southeast. This one came from the north to northeast, going southwest. This is very typical in the spring, especially if there's any high pressure building off the cold Atlantic waters. It can easily drive and overcome any very warm air mass. People in Boston know this all too well. They oftentimes, if they're on the Charles River and they're boating, they can flip sideways with the strong northeast wind coming in, dropping the temperature 20, 30 degrees. Now, it wasn't quite like that, but when I went out this morning, I was kind of surprised. It was still in the mid-60s when I left for going to my volunteer at the hospital. And then I looked again about 10 minutes later, and the temperature already had dropped. So I threw a jacket on. It's a good thing because it was a little raw this morning. And then finally, we got some sun this afternoon. Temperatures did recover to the 60s. Down in my hometown, Philadelphia, hit at least 90 degrees, tying a record that was set 50 years ago, and in the low 90s in parts of Washington, D.C., and further south. So a lot of hot air that we missed out on, and some people will probably feel frustrated. But we ended up with a pretty decent day. I mean, really, it wasn't bad at all, you know, mid-60s.
Is it me, or is April ending up on the dry side?
No, it's not you at all, Lennox. It's funny, the second half of April, we've only had 36 hundredths of an inch of rain after having, we had the really wet March and we started out gangbusters in April. The pattern has changed. Now, we talked about this last week, the El Nino. Not only is it going away, but I'm already seeing signs of a La Nina replacing it. I don't think it's officially there yet, but it's getting close. And we're starting to see ridging in the southeast, I think, and that's part of La Nina. And another very interesting thing, and a guy I used to work with, I saw him a couple days ago, brought up, and I actually looked at it, and he's right. There, even though we talk about how warm the Atlantic's been, certainly in the eastern part towards Europe, extremely warm, it's cooling down in the eastern part off the United States seaboard and further east into much of central Atlantic. It's actually that part of the Atlantic is actually cooling off, which I had noticed before, but it seems to have really accelerated in the last few weeks. So the combination of those two things seems to have changed our weather pattern. I thought we have a wet spring in the May. Now I'm not so sure. The jet stream, that the La Nina polar jet stream, or a Pacific jet stream, I should say, has actually finally weakened and is not falling apart. So we have seen a pattern change going on, and will be interesting to see how this evolves in as we work into May.
So, Hugh, with those changes, are we still in fire weather season? Does the drier April increase the risk?
A little bit, absolutely, Bria. We are still, we are officially in fire weather season until May 15th, and that's because the New York State continues the outdoor fire ban through mid-May to May 15th, and that pretty much stays steady. That's a pretty steady, constant thing, but we are getting green up now, a partial green up. We're in that transient stage where leaves are starting to bud on the trees. The grass is pretty darn green, but the ground really has dried up. I mean, we still have great water supply. Don't even talk about drought. We're not even talking about that. But the surface of the ground has definitely dried out. So we are starting to see some changes. But fire weather is still a possibility. I mean, it's still, you know, we're still in the fire weather season for the next couple of weeks. I don't see any real significant fire issues. I don't see much wind the next few days. And we will get some rain tomorrow. I don't think a whole lot, but we will get some showers tomorrow for sure. So I don't see any real threat, but we are technically, yes, we are in the fire weather season.
And Hugh, I know we've gone over this before, but could you just briefly remind us what the difference is between El Nino and La Nina?
Sure. El Nino is when we have the anomalous warm ribbon of water along the equator part of the Pacific, where you get that very warm band of water, and you also get a responsive, very strong, active jet stream creating shear in the Atlantic Ocean, which helps supposedly suppress the hurricane, but it didn't really do that much last year. But now the La Nina is when it's the opposite. It's the opposite end of what we call the ENSO, and now we cool the Pacific. And when we cool the Pacific, we usually build a ridge in the southeast. We weaken the southern jet, and we sometimes strengthen the polar jet. Being that it's summer, I don't think that's going to be a problem. But what could be very well happen is we could get a big ridge developing in the southeast, and it could be a really hot summer, especially in the southeast. And we've already seen that today. As I said, we've already seen temperatures up to 90 degrees in the mid-Atlantic, not too far away, but weren't for that backdoor shallow cool air, we would have been a lot warmer.
So with those big ridges that you're saying, do we have any chances of potentially severe weather like they're having in Oklahoma and Iowa?
Oh, yeah, that's another thing. The La Nina actually increases the threat of severe weather in the plains. Now, for us, it's kind of a wash. I mean, it could happen with either El Nino or La Nina. We've seen it both ways. But, yeah, we're starting to get in that season where we have to keep an eye. The thunderstorms will start increasing. Climatologically anyways, and we might actually have a rumble of thunder tonight with a disturbance passing through. Now, I don't think anything severe, and again tomorrow afternoon, again, I don't think anything severe, but we will have to watch. But the one thing I want to stress about thunderstorms, when we consider them severe, it does not include lightning, which is, it'd be nice if they did that, but I understand why they don't. It would make it very hard to verify and that kind of thing. But lightning is still probably the most dangerous aspect of most thunderstorms. So even if it's a generic thunderstorm, take it seriously. If you hear thunders, go indoors. It's absolutely, when the thunder roars, go indoors. But severe weather includes high winds of 60 miles an hour, a hail of inch in diameter, and any thunderstorm that produces a tornado. Those are all considered severe thunderstorms. And even if they're not severe, they're strong, you can still get some damage with winds gusting to 40 to 50. You can still knock out some power lines and things like that. So, yeah, we're getting to that season. So something to keep, especially with people being out golfing and everything, I don't see anything severe in the next few days, but we could actually see a few hear a few rumbles of thunder by this time tomorrow.
Anything else in your forecast for the rest of April heading into May?
Okay, tomorrow we have some showers. That front that's towards south, it's going to kind of meander for the next day or so, and a couple of disturbance moves along it. And then after that, we actually get a couple of nice days coming up, but maybe an early morning shower Wednesday. And then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday look pretty dry and seasonable with temperatures well up in the 60s, possibly 70 in a few warmer spots with a good deal of sunshine. Weekend looks like, unfortunately, a little disturbance coming through with the front. Nothing big, but we probably will get some showers sometime on Saturday and maybe a lingering one on Sunday before we clear out again early next week. But it looks like we're not really seeing big rainstorms in the offing, and luckily no severe weather yet. And I don't actually see – the next shower 80, by the way, it's a week from now, and that's a little late. We usually get an 80 degree by the end of April, beginning of May, so we're running a little late on that 80 degree. Sorry we didn't get it today, Bria, for you.
Thanks, Hugh, for joining us once again, and we look forward to speaking with you next week.
Absolutely. Have a great evening, everyone.
You too.
Thanks, Hugh.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, switching gears. On April 16th, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the New York State Nurses Association's picket line at Ellis Hospital, where nurses called for safe staffing and a fair contract. In the second part of his report from the line, Willie interviews two nurses on their views on the contract negotiations.
And I have, as my guest, two nurses from the Ellis Medical Center, right? Hospital?
Yep, Ellis Hospital.
And your name is?
My name's Fred DeRocher.
And you?
Kathy Dawson.
And right. Kathy Dawson. How y'all doing?
Good.
Good, thank you.
So they had a big protest out here, and I see y'all had a lot of people, a lot of red.
Yeah?
Yep.
So tell me something about this. You know, what's going on?
So
why y'all did?
We're out here today. I'm a registered nurse. I work in the ER crisis unit for 28 years. But we're out here today, basically, now I'm losing my thought process here.
We've been negotiating for
over a year. And we're very, we're here, we're frustrated. And that's what you're seeing out here on the lines, the picket lines. The nurses are frustrated. And we're also a little bit disappointed with Trinity Ellis Management.
Uh-huh.
We've been negotiating, like you said, for over a year. Over 26 sessions, and we have not been able to come to agreement. We don't feel they're offering us fair contracts. We feel they're cutting benefits. They say our benefits were actually too good, so they had to cut them. Yes, too good for the Capital Region.
Yep.
In comparison to the Capital Region, their wage increases aren't fair. They want us to abandon our pensioners on a frozen pension. They want us to sell this pension plan off to a third party, where, like the St. Clair's pensioners, they would be, there would be no 100% guarantee with these pensioners. So it's stuff like that that's very frustrating with us. There are also the ratios that we have negotiated in the contract. They've handed into the state for the nurse, so one nurse to three in the ER, one nurse to four on the med-surg floors and psych floors. They want to increase all those numbers. Even though they're actively not following what the ratios are right now, they want to increase them in the contract. When it's proven to me, when you increase those numbers, one nurse to five patients in the ER, six, seven, eight patients on the floors, that you worsen their outcomes, and you make it's more unsafe for the patient, and it's also terrible for the nurse. You can't retain any of the new nurses because of the environment in there. We have less nurses working than we did in 2020.
Correct.
We have less beds throughout the hospital, the ER, the inpatient units, than we did in 2020. So if a pandemic were to happen tomorrow, this hospital is in a worse situation than it was to handle a pandemic in 2020 with no knowledge that that just happened.
So they, not laying off people, but if people leave, they're not
exactly
replacing them.
Exactly. So, they've had opportunities to keep the ratios better, perfect, and they have not chosen to do so. Currently, they have a number of agency nurses in the emergency room that they just got a bunch of them in the last month. And with that influx of staff for them, even though they're agency, they they cut the hours for the regular workers to extra hours for the regular workers and maintain the ratios way over what they're supposed to be. They maintain them at 1 to 5. So, you know, without even trying to create a better environment for the people that are working.
Now, what reason are they giving for doing all this? Are they saying?
Yeah. Well, not that they're saying. My thought on what they're doing. Well, they're all about economics. As what we can afford and stuff like that. And they'll say there's less patients, but there aren't. There's still quite a lot of patients coming in. If you go into our ER right now, there's a lot of admitted patients that hold down in the ER. But they're about the economics. They're a $1 billion corporation, Trinity, that is taking over a not-for-profit and trying to squeeze every cent out of it, you know, in whatever way they can. And you look at Burdette down in Troy and Sverdlovsk, and the same, that's what's happened to them. And we don't want that to happen here. That's another reason why we're out fighting for that.
One of the things they want to do is replace the regular staff with per diem nurses and have them work basically full-time hours without benefits, but at a higher rate of pay.
Right.
That's unacceptable. Right. Unacceptable.
Now, you're taking this to the community too now, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Right, and what been some of the response when y'all went out?
People are shocked and surprised when they find out what's going on because they really don't think that it's a problem or that, I don't think people, you don't think about the hospital until you need the hospital, you know, until someone's injured or sick.
Does it mean that when somebody come in the hospital?
They think it's automatically going to be there. Right. It's automatically going to be staffed well. And then you come in and, you know, you have long waits in the ER. You have a nurse. So you think it's an emergency, but to that nurse, you're her fifth priority. And I've got, you know, four other things to do before I can come back to you. So you're frustrated, you're mad at the nurse that's there. So it's a very hard environment. You go up to the floor and say it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and you're like, where is that nurse? Well, she's got seven other patients that she's trying to take care of. And it's just a one person. So, you know, it's the stress level causes such burnout in people to leave.
Right.
They like to say there's a nursing shortage, but it was said earlier today that it's not a nursing shortage. It's a shortage of nurses willing to work in the hospital because they don't want the stress and the burnout.
Now, you said something about they took some things back from you. You know, they like from you that you had, and they said your benefits were so good. They took some. Now, they could do that based on the fact that you had a prior contract?
Yes. They can negotiate. Yeah. And they, you know, so they're trying to negotiate new, you know, health benefits with, you know, worse deductibles and stuff like that, and taking away sick time to change it
and stuff like that. Extended time.
But it seems like it should be some kind of a law against that. I mean, you got the prior contract, and it shouldn't, everything should remain in place until you get a new contract.
Correct.
So they're just...
Right, so it's in place for us. So nothing's changed because of our contract. Nothing's changed, and we have to agree to it. And we don't agree with it. That's why we're out here. But for some of the other workers, I mean, even some of those security guards up there right now, their benefits and all that changed January 1st. They had no say in it. No say in any, you know, benefits from just their health insurance changes to higher deductibles. Paying more yearly, they say they reduce the cost, but it's actually you pay it twice more a year, so the cost is more. Limiting their pharmacy usage and stuff like that, so it gets much more expensive in certain pharmacies.
So what is the staff here?
What's the staff?
Yeah, you know, how many people on this, how many workers?
How many nurses?
Yeah.
We're what, 400?
I think so.
I'm not 100% sure of that.
The numbers change a lot.
So each hospital will negotiate their own contract. Like,
correct.
Y'all got to get to...
we've been doing that. Like, right. Having monthly meetings of all the area area hospitals to help each other out.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are, like, I believe Albany Med will be negotiating a new contract soon. So we're working on, like, supporting each other as institutions so we can get fair contracts.
Right. So when they
glad to be here, man. Keep it up. Keep it up.
Yep. Thanks.
Because when they go for separate hospitals, they can work on here and cut this one.
Correct.
And then they, like you said, they said y'all benefits was more was more better than Albany.
Right. Yeah. Well, according to their words, is they compared our benefit package to the region, and they felt we were above average, so they decided to cut some of it. So instead of bringing the region up, right, kind of, you know, I don't know how that recruits nurses to come work here. I don't know how that recruits right. anybody to come work
One
here.
One of the reasons that I actually came here 8 years ago was because their pay was better and their benefits were better. That's a big recruitment piece. Like, yep. I had really good health care, really good paid time off, really good rate of pay, and they just want to eliminate that. Yep. People
then,
won't come
you know,
for
if
that.
You throw, if they would be able to advertise, if they had great staffing ratios and they were committed to their staffing ratios and create a better work environment, that would be a great recruitment tool, but also a retention tool.
Right.
A lot of, nurses, all of us in the hospital, all those guys, they're trying to do their best, and that's what they became a nurse for, to do their best. You know, you didn't do it to be stressed out and to feel, don't not feel like you're able to complete your job on a daily basis. So it's very frustrating for nurses up there.
So you did this today. What are the next steps? I mean, what do you plan to do after this?
We'll go back to negotiations again and see where yeah. if there's any movement.
So
if
are
there's
you not planning any more rallies or negotiations?
Nothing at this. We don't have anything set. Yeah.
Nothing set in stone.
Back with yeah. you'll be back out. Right? You got a protest.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And your name again?
Kathy Dawson.
And you'll be?
I'm a registered nurse in the operating room. I'm on the executive committee, and I'm also on the NYSNA board of directors.
Okay. I'm Fred Rocher, registered nurse at the Ellis ER Crisis Unit, and I'm also on the executive committee at the hospital.
All right. Thank you again.
Yeah.
Right,
we also have a pamphlet for the community. We would like people to sign up to send an email. If I can give you the pamphlet or whatever.
Well, Mark, tell the people on here.
I don't know.
If they go online or anything, and if they're anything online, they can go online.
Yeah. Yes, there's a, I think there's, is that the one with the QR code, right?
Yeah, can they go online and, you know, fill out a petition or something? Yeah, just tell them.
They can go online to bit.ly/ellis/medicine.letter. And send that. It'll prompt you through some things to send to the CEOs of Ellis Medicine and the St. Peter's Trinity.
All right, thank you.
That was Willie Terry with his second report from August 16th picket line at Ellis Hospital. Part one of this report can be found on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we hear about a cool new youth program being developed by the Underground Railroad Education Center in Albany.
At a time when many locations are banning the teaching of the Civil War or of African American history, here in Albany, we have an organization that is doing just the opposite. The Underground Railroad Education Center is focused on preserving, sharing, and interpreting the history of the Underground Railroad, framing it as a major civil disobedience movement to help people escape enslavement. Beyond their new interpretive center, they also are creating a program to introduce the next generation to museum studies. I'm now talking with Lacey Wilson of the Underground Railroad Education Center, who is shaping the new program. Lacey, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You said that this is non-credit bearing, but it will be introducing teens to museum studies. So I guess my first question is, what does that include?
We're keeping it very broad. We want to capture students who are remotely interested in the arts, in the humanities, and the sciences, and the stories that all of those subjects entail, and how best to tell those stories, either through exhibits or programming or tours or what other methods it is to tell stories like that.
And you mentioned before I started taping that you have a bachelor's in history, but a master's in museum studies. How do you envision this program being different than your master's program or being similar to your master's program?
Well, to start off, it'll be a lot cheaper. But I think primarily we really want to introduce a lot of concepts and a lot of the projects and programs that we're hoping to run with these teenagers with this program will be a lot smaller in scope and really just sort of introducing the skills and reiterating some of those early skills that one would need to be able to take these to the larger level. For example, I think being able to do public speaking, the sooner you learn that and the more you practice you get at it, the better you can get at it for sure. And we would just want to introduce practice to that with teenagers and for the students with this, which is very different than a master's student creating a tour or reciting a speech or a dissertation.
Now, for many years, Underground Railroad Education Center has had a teen program during the summer, but this is different. It's a longer program and more intense program, right?
That is currently the plan. It is still being planned out, so a lot of these things are still pretty up in the air, but we are hoping this to be a much longer program to introduce a variety of concepts. So it would probably be longer than just the summer, but it would probably also include the summer.
And you said that you are possibly working with Rochester Institute of Technology to make it a credit-bearing program?
What I said was I'm hoping that this will lead students into looking at various programs, in particular, including RIT's Museum Studies program. One of their professors has been very helpful at the Underground Railroad Education Center and with me in setting up and beginning to set up this program. So we're hoping we can convince students perhaps to continue their education beyond our program at RIT or other programs.
Now, you mentioned one of the skills is public speaking. What are some of the other skills that you hope the teens will get?
I think storytelling is key. I think being able to tell a story well, impactfully, and understand what you want an audience to understand out of that story. So being able to understand an audience and plan for an audience would also be key. As well as there's a lot of creative muscles that can be stretched when you're creating an exhibit or creating a tour or creating an art project or something for an audience to engage with.
And you mentioned it's for teens. Are we talking high school graduates? How do you envision the participants?
I think we're hoping for high school juniors and seniors, for high school juniors to sort of introduce a lot of these concepts and projects. And if they remain interested beyond that first year, we can add a level and create larger projects for them to really stretch their legs a bit more on, for sure.
Will participants be paid for participating as the youth program in the summer works, or is this more a free program for them? How is it structured?
We are still in the planning phases of that, so we don't know for sure. I would like them to be paid, but we're still so early in the planning. This program will begin fall of 25, so there's still so much planning still being involved. So I cannot say definitively that whether we would have paid students or not, but I would like to.
Now, you've been involved with African American history in the Albany area, but you recently came to the Underground Railroad Education Center. How long have you been here, and what's the most interesting thing that you've discovered or worked on while you're here?
This is the beginning of my third month here at the Underground Railroad Education Center. I think what's most exciting for me is the breadth of ways to engage with this larger story. We have a garden. We've got this upcoming museum conference that the folks are going to be speaking at. I think there's a lot of engagement with local organizations. We have a Girl Scout troop here, as well as just being able to be involved with an organization that's growing and thus actively fundraising for its new interpretation center. I feel like this is all kind of on the precipice of growing bigger already.
Besides the teen program, what are some hopes that you have for what might develop here at Underground Railroad Education Center?
I think I'm most excited for the Interpretive Center and the possibilities that it brings us to be able to have more space, to be able to engage more with the stories that we're already engaging with, but on a larger level and within more space. I'm hoping for more programs and more collaborations across the Capital Region with that space.
You've been mostly focused on developing the program, but along the way, have you come across stories in the African American history, in the Underground Railroad history, that interest you in telling the story?
We are just getting to the point of perhaps me starting to give tours here, but I think we're still very early on in that. So another time I might be able to give you something of that, but I haven't really delved into the research quite enough to be able to give you that. I've only taken one tour with Paul.
Paul is Paul Stewart, one of the co-founders, or as he says, co-instigators of what was formerly known as the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region, Inc. So thank you, Paul, for shortening the name. When you said collaborating with other organizations, are there places in town that you already are working with or places that you hope to be working with that you want to mention?
There are a few that they were already in contact with before I started, so I feel comfortable saying I think there's interest from the State Museum. I think there's interest from, what's that organization in Troy that I'm forgetting? Hartcluet. I think there's like a lot of opportunity, but keeping in mind that we're hoping to really engage students with interest in art, history, and natural sciences, we are the Underground Railroad Education Center, so there's a lot of opportunity to connect further with people who have more breadth and space within the arts and in the natural sciences that we do not currently have expertise in really in the same way.
And in terms of recruiting students for this, do you envision yourself working with the high schools? How will potential students and participants learn about this?
That is also currently being planned because this is for fall of next year. But I think we definitely do want to get in contact with high schools. I was recently a judge at National History Day, so I got to see what some of the students who, given the opportunity and incentive to work on an individual history project, what they will do. So connecting with the schools who are involved there for sure. I think you want to connect with nearly any organization that actively works with kids creatively in the Capital Region, because if there's any interest, we want to be able to harness that or have people draw and point toward us as an opportunity to further develop the kids.
You just mentioned National History Day.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and about what kinds of things you said you judged.
National History Day is like a science fair for history, and it occurs nationally every year. There's a regional, we have the Capital Region had their version a few weeks ago, and then they go to the state, and then they go to the national thing of that. Judges will review projects, either documentaries or exhibits or papers or whatever methods that exist at the time that kids will do based on the theme of the year.
What was the theme this year, and what were some of the cool things that you saw?
I saw several documentaries. A lot of them were kind of focused on colonial times. I saw a Stamp Act documentary. I saw one on the Battle of Saratoga Springs. Those are the two that are sticking out in my mind. I was on the documentary team, and we watched like 7 or 8 documentaries over the course of a few hours.
That sounds wonderful. And if people want more information, how do they find out about Underground Railroad Education Center?
I would send them right to the website.
That website is undergroundrailroadhistory.org?
Yes, it is. There's plenty of information on their website. We're also pretty active on social media, so you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners?
No, I think we covered all I have right now.
Okay, and again, that's Lacey Wilson at the Underground Railroad Education Center at 194 Livingston Avenue in Arbor Hill. It's a former home of Stephen and Harriet Myers, African-American abolitionists. We have I'm a volunteer here off and on, have documentation of them helping many people escape slavery, or as Paul would say, the institution of slavery, as a reminder that it wasn't just some people participating in this, but it was an officially sanctioned activity in the U.S. So, Lacey, thanks so much.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
That was my co-host, Bria Battelle, talking with Lacey Wilson on the Underground Railroad Education Center about the exciting new program that the center is developing for the youth.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Lennox Aputo. Our engineer is the ever-amazing Sina Basila Hickey. We thank all of the other volunteers who made today's episode possible, including Mark Dunley for segment production and Morse headlines, Willie Terry for segment production, and Hugh Johnson for his weekly look at climate and weather. We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear the local news, or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at any time at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. And thanks to you, our listeners, including our live streamer in Kenya, for making this all worthwhile.